It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Port Authority of Allegheny County is hoping the third time is the charm when it comes to seeking federal funds to kickstart the bus rapid transit project. Catherine Kellerman is the CEO of the Port Authority. Welcome back to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
As the lead agency, you submitted an application last month to the Federal Transit Administration. Have any of the main components, such as the route, the equipment needed, changed in this latest proposal?
There are yeses and nos, so I know an equivocal answer there. When we started our outreach up again in the winter of 2018, we heard really loud and clear from folks that the way we had designed service was not as convenient as it could be for them. So we came back, changed the way the route would operate so folks would not have to transfer, right? So if you're on the 61D, you wouldn't have to transfer now to a bus rapid transit. You could just, your bus would turn into that service. So this has been a bit of a realignment for where the station stops go, what they look like on the branches. We are still getting electric buses in for this. We're still committed to really great bike and pedestrian infrastructure, especially in Uptown. The application we put in did still talk about full reconstruction on 5th and Forbes. A road reconstruction project is a really long-term project, especially could be a long winter, could be a rainy spring. Right. And what we need to get done with bus rapid transit just doesn't line up on that schedule. So we'll be doing resurfacing on 5th and Forbes, and that should let us get some improvements out there by 2022 and full service by 2023.
And a reminder, the main link is downtown in Oakland, and then the branching off to Highland Park, parts of Greenfield, and some eastern suburbs.
Absolutely.
What about the vehicle that we'll use? Has that changed at all?
The vehicle type is the same type for that corridor. We were going to start adding electric buses on the East Busway to help out with our neighborhood connections. We're still doing that. Originally, we had talked about 25 buses. We're bringing in 11 for this. We are using this as our test drive to go fully electric on the fleet. So fewer moving parts, much quieter, and clearly a much better air quality investment. We want to make sure we can do that here, though. So we're taking delivery of 2 electric buses this fall and 6 more next year that will be focused on this BRT area. And once we're successful there, we can start getting electric throughout the city.
The electric vehicles on an individual basis, cost basis, they're more expensive than the diesels?
They are. So the diesel buses are still coming in at about $600,000 to $650,000. We keep them for 12 years. We'll probably drive them for 600,000 miles. The electric buses are still clocking in anywhere from 900,000 to a million. They are much cheaper to keep, much lower operating costs, don't have to rebuild an engine, for instance. But the cost you save on that still is not as much as a delta on the price. So as those buses continue to become less expensive, it makes more sense for us to migrate over.
You mentioned that the new plan does not include the rebuild of 5th and Forbes. What would that have done? And why does it not include? Would it have delayed BRT or what?
It would be a longer time frame, absolutely. So resurfacing, paving, and milling, we're talking about taking off about the first 4 inches of pavement, smooth it out, improve any kind of surface irregularities, still going all the way to the sidewalk, still expanding pedestrian facilities, still adding bike lanes. To do a full reconstruction, you take out everything on the foundation of that road. You're looking at a lot of utility relocation. And anything that's under 5th and Forbes that we might not know exactly what's there, and I guarantee there's a lot, we're going to find it and have to deal with it in the rebuild. Mm-hmm. And also, since it takes longer, you have more exposure to what happens if you have a rainy spring, what happens if you have an extra long winter, and that pushes that out. So it would be a great project to have been able to get done, but to get BRT up and running in the timeframes we've committed, which is about 2-3 years from now, we just can't get that with a full reconstruction.
What's the bigger factor? Is there one? The unknowns when you do it or the cost of doing that complete rebuild?
Wow, I say the bigger factor on it is really the time frame. So when you're rebuilding roads like these, and these are major corridors in the city, you're shutting down the entirety of 5th or Forbes. Where can you go? If Forbes is closed, where do you turn and divert? You don't. So what is that backup plan if you completely close the road down? And how long do you expect people to be patient with that? But we can get a lot of these benefits for the road. It'll look for somebody coming through there exactly like we've done a full rebuild by taking the top and working on that.
Catherine Kelman, the CEO of the Port Authority of Allegheny County, is our guest on The Confluence. The BRT project, from the time it was just the idea was floated to the first application for federal funds, and since you've been here, the price has changed. Right now, what is the approximate estimated cost of the bus rapid transit project?
We have an application at the FTA that's just under $250 million, and it includes full road reconstruction. Since all the partners have come together and said, hey, we're going to separate that reconstruction from BRT, they really are two separate projects, it's about $25 million less expensive and 3 years faster. That moves us to an iteration where, yes, it is more expensive, but it's contingencies and it's, you know, the price of a bus going up or how much does concrete cost? And they're things which we would anticipate. We're still asking for the same portion under the Federal Transit Administration funding. So the rest of this is coming up on our local funding.
Last I saw, your request from the FTA was $99.5 million.
Yes.
That is, well, mini grants are supposed to be under $100 million.
Right. And we are.
Yes.
Well, and to clarify, we had been asking for $95 million in the first round of applications. So our request to the Federal Transit Administration has gone up $4 million. This actually works well for the attractiveness of the project because we're not asking for the FTA to cover half. It's getting closer to 45 or 40% because this means we'll have more local funding that's obligated to help out.
Speaking of local funding, do you have commitments for the remainder of that money? Who's coming in first?
Right. Where's the juice and the squeeze, right?
Yeah.
We do actually have commitments. So we have letters of commitments from our friends at the city and at Allegheny County. We've also submitted our letter of commitment. We have grants or other programs, which are essentially in-kind funding. So we, for instance, would buy buses to go in this corridor anyhow. That counts as part of our funding. Our next steps on these commitments are to be able to call out exactly where it is in a budget. So, for instance, when our board adopts an updated budget on Friday the 27th, it includes funding for BRT, and we can send that piece of paper to the Federal Transit Administration, say, not only did we write a letter promising, here's the budget and here's the action that was taken to allocate that.
Right.
So that's a process we're in now to show it's not just pinky swear, it's actually committed funding.
So the total cost of several million dollars more than was proposed earlier or projected earlier, was that just cost estimates going up or is it contingency funds just in case? What?
We took our contingency down pretty lean on that 195 bid. And again, that, you know, we're dealing with roads here in Pittsburgh. What's the worst that could happen? So there is a lot of this funding change. There's the contingencies expanding. I hesitate to say this. I'd be shocked if we use the whole thing, but better to budget for a big contingency and be able to return value to the taxpayers than have to come out later and say, oh, hey, we lack some iteration of funding. And now something else we promised to do can't go forward. Because again, the BRT is a great project. But if you thought we were putting in a shelter in your neighborhood in McKeesport and we can't do that for the BRT, Port Authority hasn't done our job.
So when do you think you will get a handle on when it, you know, the solid figure? I mean, is it while it's being built, when it's done, when?
So that's an excellent question. We will have a really good idea of what this costs us definitely by the end of the year as we move toward 90% design. But I hate to say anything could happen, but I mean, in the time I've been here, we've had two floods and a train has landed on us. So things will shift and things will move. Ideally, not so much that we can't afford the project, right? There are agencies that have been refining their project up to the time they've torn up the concrete to put down new pavement because they could find more efficient or better ways of serving the public. And clearly, we want to keep that flexibility in there if a better idea or option pops up, but still live within the constraints that we've got on the funding and, again, what we said we were going to do.
Are you still fine-tuning the BRT proposal, what you would like to do, and really how much wiggle room do you have to make any significant changes?
So significant changes, that ship has sailed. We are at 60% design, so now what we're looking at are, you know, where does a bus stop get moved downtown or in the corridor, which stops are discontinued so we can be on time. And then what does the improvement look like at a stop that's there? So, for instance, when we thought we'd have a lot of people transferring, in this corridor from the outlying areas, we had a different idea of what a shelter should look like. Now that you don't have to make that transfer, the shelters can be more oriented toward people who are really getting off and on at those stops. So you might not have such an enclosed shelter. You might have something that's easier for folks to pass through pedestrian-wise or has a different line of sight to the street. So those are the kind of things, not necessarily cosmetic, but we are not moving things significantly from here.
Why is the BRT important to your customers to this region?
If you have ever been stuck in traffic in Oakland, it's important to you, whether you were on a bus, whether you were in a car. We're linking the second and third largest job centers in the Commonwealth together. Again, almost 20% of our bus ridership happens in this corridor. If you're in Uptown, you are not just a pass-through, you're a neighborhood that should feel safe walking and having bus service that doesn't clog your streets. So this gives us a chance to clean up that experience. Right now, we have a bus every 1.8 minutes going through Oakland, and they never pass, and they stop on every corner. So if you're trying to get through Oakland, we're definitely at this point not part of the solution. BRT lets us clean up our operations and our stop locations and work with our partners at the city and county and state to put in smarter signals and get through intersections faster so everybody has a faster trip through this corridor.
When do you hope to hear from the Federal Transit Administration about your application?
We expect to hear from the Federal Transit Administration in the late winter, early spring of next year on the BRT project. We work really closely with the FTA. And in fact, they're in town today for a big review of all of our projects. It's a regular review, but it's a chance to work really closely with them and show how in the past year our tactical plan has helped us deliver for our customers and how that moves into our strategic plan and our long-range service plan. So we have a very close relationship with them. They're great, great partners.
The FTA has given you high marks in the past, but are you confident this time that they'll come through with the money in addition to those nice comments?
The issue at this point is, are we ready? Do we have our funding commitments? Is our project far enough along that we can tell them we're ready for that grant? And I think we're there.
Catherine Kellerman is the CEO of the Port Authority of Allegheny County. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Adult changing facilities and public restrooms are pretty rare. That leads many with disabilities and their caregivers to last resorts like changing on the restroom floor or avoiding going out altogether. Now, a new bill in the State House might make adult changing tables more common. And contract employees at Google's Pittsburgh offices are unionizing. They plan to bargain for job security and a reduction in pay disparities. What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Email us at wesa.fm/confluence. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Pittsburgh hosts the G20 summit in 2009. The city was chosen by President Barack Obama because it represented economic recovery and industry change following the collapse of manufacturing. Most of the summit was held at the Convention Center downtown, but some events were at other locations like Phipps Conservatory. Thousands of protesters also attended, participating in demonstrations against capitalism and calling for peace and environmentalism. At one protest in Pittsburgh's Lawrenceville neighborhood, police fired pepper spray at a crowd of hundreds to disperse before that day's summit. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. State-owned buildings and some public facilities, including convention centers, sports arenas, auditoriums, and amusement parks, would be required to install at least one adult changing station under legislation introduced Monday in both the Pennsylvania House and the Senate. Joining us in studio is parent and advocate for those with disabilities, Christina Abernathy, who helped write that legislation, as well as Josie Badger. She's a doctor of health ethics. She's a disability advocate and owner of a disability consulting firm. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
For those who aren't familiar, would you describe an adult changing table and why they're so needed in public spaces? Christina, let's start with you.
Sure. So an adult size changing table, they are typically around 72 inches, 6 feet long. They're about 2.5 feet wide. The ones that we specifically are asking for are powered height adjustable changing tables. This is for a lot, mainly for safety reasons. So that the table is able to be lowered down to the height of someone in a wheelchair. It goes right to the level of the chair. You're able to transfer safely over. And then once the person is on the table safely, there are guide rails, safety rails on the side. It raises up so the caregiver is not hurting their back or injuring themselves. You lower back down to transfer them safely back into the chair. So that's why it's really important that the table itself is height adjustable as well.
I have to admit, I have not seen an adult changing station in facilities that I've been in. We're all familiar, whether it's in a restaurant, restroom, with those little pull-down plastic thing for baby changing. How rare are these adult changing tables?
To be honest, as a disability advocate and self-advocate who uses accessible restrooms, I've only seen a handful, and normally they're in hospitals, unfortunately, now at our airport.
So who will benefit from these? Josiah, start with you.
Sure. So I personally believe that this will benefit, of course, individuals with disabilities, of course, caregivers, but we're also looking at an aging population who I believe will greatly over time be able to benefit from this, even though maybe at this moment they don't need it.
Right.
And we have a new population, a new generation of people with disabilities who have what was once called childhood conditions, who are now becoming adults who have lives and have jobs. And these individuals such as myself were not needing tables because we weren't around. And so all of a sudden, this is a growing need, and rapidly growing.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned becoming adults. Are people with disabilities that require a changing station missing out on participating, attending a variety of events?
Absolutely, 100%. There are so often times that we are thinking about what we might do on Saturday, right? How are we going to be able to change him if he has an accident? Where can we go at this time? I mean, your options are pretty limited, and we're not going to go to Children's Hospital for a day out, right? So we're trying to get these out in the community so the families can enjoy time out together, not half the family staying at home and half the family going out. Or when you are out and there's not these accessible restrooms, you're either changing on the floor in the back of your car, or you do choose to go home because you don't want to do one of those other two options.
Josie, as an advocate, have you run into this with clients, with friends as well?
Absolutely. So we have this thing called PMATH, and PMATH is trying to figure out from the time you have a drink or any time when you're going to need to go use a restroom. And you base your day off of that equation of how much time you have. And sometimes that math doesn't add up. And so you have to make that important decision of whether you are going to let your body isolate yourself. And it's not that your own problem, it's because society has not integrated us. And we unfortunately have changing tables in the places that are medical. We know this. And so there's a lot of opportunities we're missing in the regular community that's integrated that we all should be a part of.
Christina, you've been advocating for adult changing tables for a while now. Mm-hmm. A photo of your son and an accompanying petition got a bit of attention last year. Tell us about why you decided to take a picture of your son on a public restroom floor.
I decided to take it as hard as it was. Every time that I would have to change him on the floor, you know, on a beach towel, I kept coming out with tears in my eyes, looking at my husband saying, I know that there are more people out there doing this exact same thing. It might not be our same situation, but what do people do who are caring for someone in a wheelchair? What are people doing that have adult children or adult loved ones that they're caring for? Do they just stay home? Are they doing the same thing that we're doing? And I just said, there has to be something we can do. And I started sharing our story on my Facebook page, and it did go viral, as you said, like very quickly. And it's just to get the attention of it, but to spread awareness and first and foremost, because like you said, you've never seen one. A lot of people don't even know that they are available to people. So first for me, it's awareness. And second is, what can we do? What do I have to do to help create change? Because without using our voices and sharing our stories, it's not going to happen. Mm. So that was my goal with it, was to make an impact, to be heard, and let's make change. How do we get this so that we can enjoy time out as a family out in the community?
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin, joined in studio by disability rights advocates Josie Badger and Christina Abernathy. To both of you, why do you think this issue persists? Is it just not on people's radar, the need for adult changing tables? I mean, obviously, you are advocating for it. The legislation has been introduced, but still, a lot of people are unaware. I would say most people are unaware.
Correct. Yeah. I think what's on people's radar when it comes to accessibility, they think of ramps and things like that, and how can we get individuals out into the community and be able to access that building or access that store. But this takes it one step further with accessibility when it comes to restrooms. I just don't think it's on the forefront of people's thinking when they're, you know, building a new place or something like that. But I think it's our job to speak up and say, okay, this building is accessible as far as getting individuals in. But then people still aren't coming in, and we're forgetting, like, there's this one other piece that we need in order to truly include all people.
I think that it's not on people's thoughts or minds, but I also think that restroom use is something we don't talk about very mm-hmm. much. I can often go to a store or a restaurant, but I know that a restroom will not be accessible for myself. And so it's just something we're not talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Christina, you're working with Allegheny County Democrat Representative Dan Miller to present this bill. Plus, there's a companion piece in the Senate with Republican Cameron Bartolotta and Democrat Pam Iovino. What's the reaction been in Harrisburg so far? I know it's early, but what's the reaction been?
It was extremely beneficial the other day to go out there and speak on behalf of this bill. I think we were heard, and I think eyes were opened. I really think it was a very impactful press conference to have people hear our personal stories and just really, truly think outside the box and just go, wow, I never thought of that, or wow, this really needs to change.
And Josie, I think the word's going to spread quickly about this legislation so people can call their representatives, call their senators.
Absolutely. These legislators have been extremely supportive of disability rights and the access that we need. And so I, with all my heart, believe that by just making individuals aware and by pushing legislation through, that it will happen because it is the right thing to do.
We're talking about how much space would be needed for this and what sort of cost. You mentioned earlier the power lift of these changing tables. Any idea of the cost and the space required?
Sure. So typically a family restroom is the type of restroom that these would go in. You want the privacy piece as well. So typically family restrooms look big enough to have one. I would say the changing table is about 6 feet long, so at least like 7 foot like wall span to put the changing table on. There are types that are go on the wall and then come down, can be folded up when not in use. And then there are also changing tables that are bolted into the ground, still height adjustable and powered operated. And they range anywhere between like $2,500 up to about $6,000 or $7,000, kind of depending on what you want. It's kind of like a car. Do you want the Chevy or the Cadillac? So it really just depends on the space, where you're really putting this and what type of location that we're talking about.
Again, just recently introduced, but are you hearing any pushback on this? From people say, well, it's just going to cost too much.
Not really, because the places that we are asking for these to be put in are not your small mom-and-pop restaurant down the street or, you know, your local Kogos. This is going into larger stadiums and things like that, and sports arenas and museums and zoos and amusement parks. We want to be active participants in our society, so we're not asking the little mom pop places. So not really. Some people have questions about the liability piece, but I always go back to safety, because right now people are laying their loved ones on floors or transferring from the wheelchair to a floor. And there's going to be a lot more injury, I feel, happening from that transfer than transferring them safely onto a changing table where they're able to have a dignified space and a safe space to be changed. So
Josie, would you hope that the mom and pop shops, the small restaurants would be down the line participating in this?
Ideally, everyone would be involved. However, I think we all respect that most of us are going to go out to dinner and be able to be home in a reasonable amount of time. But it's those bigger activities that are all-day events that we really believe are the starting place for this. And people with disabilities are the largest minority group in the world. And so by excluding certain population, you are excluding not only that person, but their entire family. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to make sure that everyone can come and enjoy the activity, the food.
Is Pennsylvania behind? What are other states doing? I'm sure you've studied that.
Sure. So actually, there are other states that have a bill already passed. This actually started out of the UK. They have over 1,000 accessible restrooms with not only adult-sized changing tables that are height adjustable, but also Hoyer lifts to help them lift individuals onto the table and transfer safely. So this actually started out of the UK. There are a few bills passed here in the US. California has one. We are currently working on one. Georgia's working on one, and I believe Ohio as well. And Arizona did pass a bill. They don't specify the height adjustable piece, but I know that they're working on it to make those changes too. So,
final question to both of you. What's next for you in regard to this legislative process, in regards to this particular bill to require the adult changing stations?
So for the bill, they are introducing a Senate bill. I will be back in October with them, with the senators, to discuss that in a hearing. So really looking forward to that companion bill being introduced and hopefully in this session.
Josie, are you optimistic?
I am. So next week I'm going to be meeting with some legislators in Harrisburg, and this will be on my list. From a personal side, it is these stories of both individuals with disabilities that need to be shared as long as the parents. And so that is going to be my goal, is to make sure that our stories are the ones being heard, because that is where change happens.
Yeah.
Josie Badger is a disability advocate and owner of a disability consulting firm. And Christina Abernathy is a disability rights advocate and mother of 8-year-old Ethan, who has autism. She's been working with legislators to pass a bill in Pennsylvania to require public venues to provide at least one powered height adjustable adult size changing table in their restrooms. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. By a margin of 2-1, contract workers at Google's Pittsburgh offices have voted to unionize with the United Steelworkers. What should we know about the Pittsburgh Association of Technology Professionals? WESA's Liz Reed was on site for the vote yesterday, and she joins us in studio. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning, Kevin.
So, Liz, what was the mood yesterday in Bakery Square before the vote and then after?
Well, there was maybe about a dozen people, both from the U.S. Steelworkers, with whom the workers are organizing, and also Google contract employees out on Penn and Whitfield streets with signs and stuff like that. They walked over to where the vote took place. That was very interesting. I'd never seen a union vote happen before. It's pretty simple. They just pull out all the ballots and count them. It was a little tense. People seemed a little nervous. They were sort of keeping their own tallies. When the National Labor Relations Board official read the results, people started cheering, tearing up, and hugging. You know, that's not to say it was a margin of 2-1. That's not to say every worker was in favor of unionizing, though.
This will affect 80 contract workers. What do they do for Google?
They fill a data analysis role, is what a couple of workers told me. So they're not computer programmers per se, but they are in a tech role. That's unique in terms of organizing, because so far what we've seen in terms of people organizing in the tech sector, we've seen, like, for example, bus drivers for Facebook and Google organizing. But this is the first sort of tech or tech adjacent role that we've seen organizing.
We've been saying contract workers.
Yeah.
Who's their direct employer?
So they're employed by a company called HCL Technologies, which is based in India. And so HCL has been contracted by Google to work on a particular project.
Steelworkers Union say the organizing efforts began earlier this year. What are these workers, contract workers, hoping to bargain for?
One of the big things they want is sick leave. They also want to close pay disparities. A couple of the pro-union workers told me that there's quite a large gap between what people are making. They want some job security. They fear that because they're on a contract that they really don't have any protections, that they don't want to be at-will employees anymore. They want better health care. And one person also told me that they're required to use a vacation day when Google offices are closed for a company holiday. They don't get that as a holiday. And so he specifically wanted that policy changed.
Do we know how HCL or Google responded to the employees' desire to unionize?
Google has not responded. HCL said that they respect the workers' right to unionize. I will say, however, that workers told me they brought in, HCL brought in a consultant who they felt was trying to dissuade them from joining the union.
You spoke with any of the workers who voted against. What are their concerns? Why did they vote no?
Yeah, one worker said she was concerned about losing autonomy and flexibility to speak with HCL leadership about her working conditions. Another worker told me that he was concerned that Google could cancel its contract with HCL altogether and everyone could lose their job, that they could no longer be as competitive. Some people also thought it just didn't make much sense because the workers are contracted to work on one particular project. And even though some have been working on that project for 5 years, they're wondering once the project is over, what happens to the union?
Liz, briefly, any sense of the potential implications of the vote, whether it's for Google Pittsburgh or even broader issue of the tech industry?
Well, we'll see what happens in terms of benefits. But again, this is unique in terms of tech workers haven't been super successful in trying to organize thus far. As far as the implications for Google, it could be a big deal because multiple media outlets have reported that contractors at Google actually outnumber direct employees. And that's not entirely unusual. Large tech companies do tend to rely heavily on contract workers.
WESA Liz Reed, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, Pittsburgh is the first U.S. city to be selected for an international honor for education innovation by renowned global nonprofit 100. We'll talk with co-founder Lasse Lapaniemi about what makes for learning innovation and how do you share the approach worldwide. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Christopher Stubbs. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.